Now today we're talking about public health as it relates to water quality in Kenya. And some people might think that we already know that water treatment's really important and that it saves lives. But there's been a tremendous buildup of, you know, not-for-profit organizations, well-intentioned religious organizations that have brought about a lot of disinfection practices to a lot of countries. And as a scientist, I think that this is a good thing, but I also believe that there's a tremendous need for assessment. And that wasn't something that I came to the conclusion on my own. It was something that I came to the conclusion upon much conversation with two of our MPH students, which you'll hear more about. Ben Chariot, who's in this picture right here, is here today. So that's Ben. He's going to be finishing an MPH at Eastern Kentucky University really soon, in a couple months. So I have no money to make off this presentation. Right. And the financial support we got for this, I put the funding folks up front because without them we wouldn't have been able to do this. So Eastern Kentucky University's MPH program with Dr. Carolyn Harvey was so kind to actually provide us with some money, and then couple of that with the major program award at Eastern in our Office of Sponsored Programs as kind of a startup. I think they'd like me to head down the Ecology of Infectious Diseases route with NSF or partnering up with a bigger school to try to do more. So, and then we had a financial, we got a little financial gift from an EKU staff member who thought that our project was really good because of the two students that were attending. Now, you know, this is kind of a rehash, but I think it's really important to really realize that 1.1 billion people in low-income countries do not have direct access to treated drinking water. That's a lot. You can't hear that statistic enough. That is a lot of people. And this accounts for about 2.2 million annual deaths due to diarrheal diseases. And that was published in The Lancet just a couple years ago. And they're the second leading cause of death among children. So children under 5 years of age are the ones that we're really concerned about. And these are just two of the folks. They're actually relatives of Peter Siglai. This was in his village. Peter was one of our MPH students. I mean, these are real kids that are at risk of dying at an amount of risk that I would deem unacceptable, definitely would be unacceptable in the United States. And Kenya, where we did our project, is actually kind of coded categorically here in the red column, suggesting that they have over 500 diarrheal deaths per 100,000 children, and that's, you know, maybe another good reason for why we went to Kenya. Now, there have been a few studies that have demonstrated the benefits of doing point-of-use disinfection, treating it at the house, maybe rainwater collection, as well as having a latrine on site so that you don't have the latrine contaminating nearby water sources, and then even having good hand hygiene practices, as well as maintaining a clean environment for collecting your water. And all these practices have been demonstrated to prevent disease spread. Now, it is difficult, though, when you look at the literature as it pertains to West Kenya and East Africa. We lost our mic. We're back. When we go to Western Kenya, there are not a lot of Well, if it doesn't get me, I can project. And I can leave my box. What we find out in East Africa is that there's not a lot of disease surveillance. And that's something that we take for granted. Disease surveillance doesn't happen without people doing it. And the district public health officers are not doing it. And it may not always present the most sexy data. And it may give us a lot of information that we thought we already knew. But a long-term, you know, data surveillance program or illness surveillance program can have a lot of benefits. And the world is constantly changing. There are a lot of alternative methods for treating water that are being introduced. And some people are presenting them as being the best or as just as effective. Without having surveillance data and not doing the assessment, we can't really compare. But the real reason why we chose to study Kenya was because of these guys. Peter Siglai and Ben Chariot, both MPH students, wanting to do their culminating experience in their home country, in their home villages. And that's why we did it. I mean, that's, you know, now they came up with some important hypotheses to address. In our program, you know, we always value global communities and anything and everything that we teach. We believe that you can go from the Commonwealth of Kentucky and the mountains of Appalachia all the way to Kenya to do important work. And we also were able to get local community support. The district public health officer in Bomet, the poorest district in Kenya, said, please come. We need people doing surveillance in our communities and working with us. And they had a good relationship already with Peter. And Ben already had a good relationship with the folks up in El Dorat. And their district public health officer was supportive. So, public treatment. You know, is it making a difference? And if so, which we suspect that it was making a difference, how much of a difference does public treatment make for preventing illnesses? And which methods work best? We want to know what methods at the house, the home treatment methods, work. And then this is kind of an interest of my own, which fecal indicator can measure or predict illness the best? Because there's a lot of people that do these quick and dirty total coliform methods, and they haven't proved very well for preventing recreational water illnesses here in the United States. And I don't think that they would do well for preventing drinking water illnesses, and that we could maybe use other methods. So that was what we wanted to explore. And we believe that gastrointestinal illness prevalence would be higher in the villages and the households with publicly treated water versus those villages that were doing their own home treatment. And we believe that the prevalence would be less among the households who don't have publicly treated water but still claimed, or at least told us, that they were doing public treatment or doing their own home treatment. I apologize. E. coli density, we believed, would be a more effective indicator of total coliforms than predicting GI illness using the total coliform method. So in order to get at this, we had to characterize the health status and exposure status of all the individuals. We would have to do some microbial water quality evaluation, and then eventually develop the statistical models to demonstrate which exposures were risk factors or good indicators for preventing illness. So we did our study in the Bomet area. They're both in the Great Rift Valley. Bomet is in southwest Kenya. El Dorat's where we collected some other samples in the burnt forest area, which is near where Ben lives. Peter Siglai lives down in the Bomet area. And we went to these villages. These villages are all adjacent to one another. People live fairly scattered. They don't live clustered like in Nairobi. The way things are in Nairobi is a lot different than it is in western Kenya. And some of these communities that are adjacent, Tenwick, there's a lot of people who have access to publicly treated water. And then when you go to the adjacent communities, they may not. Now, we recruited our participants based upon the credibility of our students. Ben was an All-American runner at Auburn. Peter was an All-American runner at the University of Tennessee. And people in western Kenya know about these guys. So when they show up at their house, they think, boy, you guys are heroes, you know, and they want to participate. And then we also provided small gifts to the local primary schools, basketballs that became soccer balls, volleyballs that became soccer balls, donated from our Department of Athletics. Notice, we only gave them to the primary students, so no NCAA violations on recruiting. And the kids, they love it, you know, and it was a good way of just building goodwill and a good way for Peter and Ben to give things back to the people at home. Now, we did this survey using a cross-sectional retrospective design where we asked people about illnesses 14 days prior and 28 days prior. And we did this survey. I do not speak Kalenjin or Swahili. I know a few words now. But without the students speaking in their native language to these folks, and even within the different dialects, you know, Kipsigi and Kaolin, you know, there would have been no way of doing this survey. So I don't know how the IRB folks approved the Swahili and Kalenjin versions of our survey at EKU, but they did. And then the Kenyan Ministry of Public Health and Sanitation was cool with our approach as well. Now, our survey, it got us the ages and genders of everybody. It categorized people as being sick or not sick based upon what the speaker of the household told us about the people living in the household. We knew where they got their water and then what disinfection practices or beliefs they at least told us that they were using. We do worry a little bit about social desirability bias. People see this white guy there at their house and they want to make, you know, they're very friendly to me, but they also want to let us know, oh yeah, we do chlorine, we do all these wonderful things, and they may have been shy and not wanting to tell us that they didn't always do those things. So I worry a little bit about desirability bias. Now, we did all this work over Christmas break just this last year, and we collected a lot of samples, 159 in a 2.5 week period of time. We used the sterile whirl packs. This is from Blue Water Bioscientific. These plates run about $10 to $15 a pop, but they're shelf stable. They can go through an airport. You don't have to refrigerate them. You pour the water on the plate. You need somewhere to incubate them, so near the kitchen area was a good spot to go. And then they tell you how many total coliforms are present based upon the blue dots. And then with a UV light, use a battery-powered one, you can actually count the number of E. coli wells. And then using an MPN table, you can convert that to tell you the maximum probable number of E. coli or the maximum probable number of total coliforms. Now, for data coding, you know, we use logistic regression, and that's sick or not sick. You've got to be 0 or 1. We identified the risk factors using a logistic regression approach, and then eventually the models and their discrimination really rely upon using some statistics to evaluate them as well. And I also created this other definition that was a highly credible gastrointestinal illness, HCGI. And HCGI was a definition that Al DeFore from US EPA used back in the mid-80s for doing recreational water illness studies in the U.S., and it's a definition that Jack Colford down at, I think he's at UC Berkeley, these guys study a lot of water-related illnesses as they pertain to swimming, and they believe that HCGI, vomiting, would be a highly credible gastrointestinal illness, and they believe that diarrhea when coupled with fever, or these conditions when coupled with fever, make the condition more credible, because if people remember, you know, when you're doing these cohort studies retrospectively or cross-sectional studies and you're doing follow-up and you're asking people whether they're sick or not, you want something that they're going to be able to report more, I guess, accurately or consistently, and people don't forget vomiting. But diarrhea, it's hard to tell if your 13-year-old kid that lives in the house has got diarrhea. But vomiting, people usually know. So, you know, I use that definition and evaluate HCGI. So we recruited 159 households out of 160. One household said no because we weren't going to buy anything off of them. So, you know, I was pretty, I mean, compared to the U.S. where I do these, you know, this kind of work on beach users, you're lucky to get a third of the people to participate, especially in Ohio during political season. Like, somehow waterborne diseases somehow relate to politics and they slam the door on you. All right, we had 846 individuals represented by those households. 13% were children less than 5 years of age, fairly equal distribution of men to women. And then when we look at among the people that we visited their house and we asked them where they get their water, you get it from the tap, you get it from, you know, and the tap would be they would open the valve outside. It was piped in to a place outside, a spigot outside. Some people would go to the water plant and actually get their water from a water treatment project. And then a lot of people would collect it from, you know, roofs. There's a variety of other ways. So most of the people we studied, this is not reflective of the area. It's reflective of our sampling strategy, which was a clustered kind of grab sampling approach. We see that the adults were less likely to be ill, but still a lot of illnesses. We see that 18% versus 28% among the children. Vomiting was much higher. Diarrhea was much higher among the children than the adults. We see that with regards to public treatment, not really a large difference among any GI illness. It keeps skipping on me. But with respect to vomiting, we see a lot more vomiting among the people without public treatment. Diarrhea, it's fairly similar. HCGI, the people without public treatment, people who do not get the publicly treated water, were more likely to get sick. Now, how does that compare to the U.S.? I mean, this was just some research we had published in 2010. We see that the gastrointestinal illnesses circled in red there were about 4 to 6%. That was in Ohio during peak, like, illness time for GI illnesses in the U.S., June, July, and August. and then you compare it to Kenya, and you're talking 17 to 21%. So, you know, there are big differences even in the areas where they don't have treated water, food contamination, a lot of other options. So getting at the models, with regards to the publicly treated water supply, as it relates to diarrhea, we did not see a significant association between the two. So there's a lot of possible reasons on why food contamination, or maybe just misclassification as things were reported to us. But with regards to vomiting, we see that public treatment significantly reduced the odds of vomiting among those with publicly treated water compared to those without publicly treated water by 60%. So 60% reduced odds of vomiting. And we see that the children had a 2.5 increased odds of vomiting than the adults. And we see that disbelief in treatment, people that don't believe that water treatment works, those people had a 6.6 times greater odds of vomiting than those who believe that water treatment works, and no gender difference. And those are all adjusted odds ratios. With HCGI, we see a significant reduction in the odds of reporting a highly credible illness among those who had publicly treated water. But I'm going to go back the area under the ROC curve. These are some stats. The discrimination is not, in my opinion, acceptable for using this as a predictive model, but it is okay for telling you that it is a risk factor when you have untreated water. This model, it hit the 70% mark. It's just on the cusp of being acceptable, and both of them have good model fit, as there's no difference between the data that the model predicts versus the data that we actually collected. So they both passed the goodness of fit test. We got ongoing work. I've only got 3 minutes left. Ben actually is working on his project, looking at those people who actually have to do the disinfection at their home. They either live too far away from publicly treated water, or they just think that it's easier to do it at home using the cistern water or the roof water that they capture in barrels. And we see that people who collect their water and do chlorination, the people who reported chlorination to us, there was no significant benefit. There's a lot of possible reasons. Not using enough chlorine, too much turbidity in the water for the chlorine to be effective. So these household chlorination methods may not be working. Type of filtering. Now, if they use some type of filtering, whether it be a biosand filter, it seemed like filtering actually was presenting a significant benefit. 75% reduced odds of having a vomiting situation among those who did filtering versus those who do not do filtering. Sunlight disinfection did not present, the direction of the association suggests that it's beneficial, but it did not achieve significance. Boiling did not, other methods did not. Now, we did only survey like 159 households, and now we're talking about 450 people who were actually, potentially exposed to these, treatment strategies. The big one, though, at the end is people who claim to use two or more methods had an 80% reduced odds of vomiting versus those who may have used, nothing. So two or more methods presented a significant benefit. And this is something that I'm interested in, just kind of really generating a good model that explains illness in this environment where we coupled the indicators. Total coliform did not work. I'm just presenting that we did look at the E. coli levels. E. coli did not behave linearly in the logit, so I used a quartile approach. And we see that the people who were exposed to the highest E. coli levels in their drinking water, who may have been children, and who actually did not do any water treatment, were the ones that were the greatest risk. We see that water treatment using two or more methods presented an 86%, the people who did two or more methods had an 86%, decreased odds of vomiting compared to those who used no treatment. And children were, again, at great risk, 4.4 times greater odds of vomiting. So that model's got good discrimination and really good fit. And we got ongoing work with OSU. We sent a bunch of water samples. We did these DNA we didn't do the extraction on site. We actually collected the filters. So the filters capture all the bacteria, and then we sent that up to OSU, where the postdocs that work in Dr. Lee's lab have been actually trying to figure out what could be in the water. Because rough water samples were heavily contaminated. Birds, where do they hide? And the gutters were lined with droppings from the birds. So rainwater collection systems might be beneficial compared to stream collection systems, but they still present new risks that may not have been previously explored. So my iPads tell me I'm out of time. So all right, those, you know, well, I kind of already hit the conclusions for you guys. But the most important conclusion I want to give you guys is that when you enable international MPH students that might be in your programs, if there's any academics in the room, you can help them pursue their passions, and it can generate high-quality research for an academic here in the United States. And it can be tough, hard work in a remote and rural location, but because it's challenging, that's where the greatest rewards are at. You know, you get to meet this like 87-year-old lady and her two goats. And we have a lot of people we could thank. Mike Mika, coach, you know, he was the district public health officer in Beaumont. Panina, who was like Ben's neighbor almost. And then the students, we had a lot of faculty support, Dr. Harvey, Dr. Brown, all the departments giving us stuff to take over there. So there's a lot of good things. So if you want to contact me, there's my information. I'll stay after. We'll handle the questions. You can get my business card. And I'm all out of time. So thank you all for being patient with me.
Can you put one
into the other side? You got it.